Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
In the Gospels, we noticed that the Jews had many questions about how far they ought to allow the Romans to dictate to them. The Pharisees asked Jesus whether Jews had to pay taxes to Caesar. And showing them a coin, Jesus asked them whose image was on it. Of course, Caesar's, they replied. Give to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Book of Acts informs us of a number of seditious movements that attempted to overthrow Roman rule of the Jews, such as those described in Acts 5:36 and 37. Emperor Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome in Acts 18:2, that's recorded, and it's probably because of the Jewish uprisings, and this included Jewish Christians as well. Is it possible for a Christian to join one of these underground movements for the liberation of Israel from the Roman yoke? That was really one of the questions in the early church. John Murray observes that because Paul repeatedly cautions early Christians against making trouble with the authorities, as Peter does also, there must have been a problem with Christians concluding that because Christ alone is Lord, they were obligated only to him, even in the civil sphere. Paul tells us here that civil authorities derive their ultimate power from God himself, and this is true even in the case of the Caesars and their representatives who were actually claiming to be gods themselves. In a fallen world, order is better than chaos, even if Christians are being persecuted, both Peter and Paul told the believers. Now, this kind of thinking might strike us as a bit foreign today, especially when we so often conclude, as one presidential hopeful a few years ago put it, that only Christians and Jews were fit to hold office. Luther, I think, captured Paul's advice here when he declared, "It would be better to be ruled by a competent Muslim than by an incompetent Christian." The Westminster Confession of Faith also stated, at a time when the Pope believed that he had ultimate jurisdiction, even in political affairs, quote, "Infidelity or indifference in matters of religion doth not make void the magistrate's just and legal authority, nor free the people from their due obedience to them, from which ecclesiastical persons are not exempted." Excuse me. "Nor doth the Pope have any power and jurisdiction over them in their dominions or lives if he shall judge them to be heretics." I'm sorry. Paul says that all powers are ordained of God, but here at least those of us in the Reformed tradition would distinguish between God's revealed will and his decreed of will. For instance, it's clear that the tyrannical reign of Nero was both immoral and yet ordained or decreed by God for his own secret purposes. His rule violated God's revealed will, but fulfilled his secret plan. The same could be said of all horrible rulers down through the ages. We must not, as Christians, respond to political or social crises as though we were responsible for whether God's will was done in any given place or age. Now, of course, in following God's revealed will and being enlightened by his moral law, we seek that which is just and right in society, but we don't see disaster, disappointment, or frustration the way non-Christians view these. Where God's revealed will does come into play, Paul would surely have concurred with Peter's insistence that we must obey God rather than men. In fact, Peter offered a helpful distinction in his first letter. "Fear God," he said, "honor the king." Now notice that distinction. In other words, we're never to fear secular rulers in the sense that we believe they hold the key to our destiny. And so often today, I think we do rely on the state to save us from everything from physical illness to ignorance to moral, spiritual, and psychological problems. But Peter says we are to fear only God while we honor the ruler. This teaching from the Apostle Paul in Romans 13 has been significant in the great debates on the duties of Christian subjects to their rulers throughout history. When is civil disobedience justified? Was, for instance, the American Revolution justified? What are the duties of Christians to the government? And how far must they go before they say enough is enough? from Operation Rescue's arrests to the decision of some Christians to refuse to pay taxes that are thought to be taken and spent in immoral ways, this passage takes on a fresh relevance. Leading our discussion, as usual, are Kim Riddlebarger, a Christian Reform minister and vice president of CURE, Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, ordained in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and a professor at Concordia University, Christ College in Irvine, and I'm Mike Horton, ordained in the Reformed Episcopal Church, and CURE president, although I don't take any personal responsibility for my voice right now, or for CURE in general. Goodness, I can't believe I got all the way through that without coughing my lungs out.
That's what you get for laughing at Benny Hinn.
Goodness. Well, let's read our passage, and then we'll go to our commercial, where hopefully I can have medical assistance.
Let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath upon the one who practices evil. Wherefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience' sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another, for he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. And this do, knowing the time, that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep. For now salvation is nearer to us than when we believed. The night is almost gone, and the day is at hand. Let us, therefore, lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual promiscuity and sensuality, not in strife and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh in regard to its lusts.
It's a very controversial passage. First of all, isn't there a danger in us coming to a passage like this with our own contemporary society in view, rather than taking the text at face value as speaking to its first century primary audience?
That's a great point. You have to remember that Romans chapter 13 comes after Paul's lengthy instructions to Jewish Gentile congregations of house churches throughout the city of Rome. And so Jewish people primarily who had congregated in the synagogue house church situation had theological problems with being under the rule of Gentiles. So that's the first century background for Paul's instruction here to the Jews and the Gentiles who had now become believers in Jesus Christ and were part of these house churches in Rome.
What's the purpose Paul gives us here for submitting to the governing authorities? What's his rationale?
Well, in verse 1 of chapter 13, he says, everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. And the obvious implication of that is God has established government as a legitimate authority.
Now, what about in the case, I mean, clearly, here, Paul was addressing Christians who were living under a church that was oppressive, that was tyrannical, that was persecuting Christians.
A state that was.
Yes, a state. And why does he tell them that this authority has been established by God?
Well, because it has been established by God. A state, even a tyrannical state, even the Roman Empire with its persecution of the church and persecution of Christians, in a sense, is a minister of God to restrain evil. Anarchy is the worst of all possible conditions for human society. And so even a tyrannical government, a government that will stand under the judgment of God for misusing its power, certainly, but that government still provides roads and civil order in all the provinces. And so the gospel's going forward throughout the Roman Empire, taking advantage of the highway system that the Roman Empire had built.
One of our commentators says this in commenting on 13, no particular form of authority is specified, imperial, monarchical, oligarchical, republican, democratic. Whether this authority is exercised in a noble or in an oppressive manner, whether it was attained in a legitimate or an illegitimate way, neither limits nor qualifies the Christian's position. One implication is plain. Anarchy is not according to the will of God.
Mm. Yeah, Calvin made the same comment when he said that it was anarchy. Tyranny is horrible, and Calvin has a lot to say about tyranny. He hates
Calvin
it.
Calvin hated tyrants, yeah.
But he says the only thing worse than tyranny is anarchy. And he says, therefore, we have to conclude that there was even enough justice and wisdom in ancient pagan Rome to justify submitting to the authorities that God had ordained. Before we get to the practical questions that this raises, obviously, there are different approaches to the relationship between the Christian and the state, aren't there? I mean, historically, especially...
Yes.
Let's look at the major communions, Christian communions today.
We should throw in the bibliographic class of one book there, H. Richard Niebuhr.
Yeah, Christ and Culture.
Christ and Culture. It's in a class of one.
Absolutely. Anabaptism, the first one.
Well, historically, Anabaptism would be seen as a view similar to modern communism. The idea of withdrawal from the state, collective gathering of Christians who don't participate in forms of government. Some of the Schlatheim Confession and others talking about the need to withdraw from government, not to be involved in government. Christians are to withdraw from secular society altogether and set up communal situations where they can place themselves under their own authority and not have anything to do with the government. That clearly is not supported by what Paul's talking about here in Romans chapter 13.
How about the Roman Catholic view on the other end?
Well, Niebuhr says that that there's a relationship there of comfortability. And the reason, down deep, at least in classical Catholicism, is that finally the papacy is the ruler over all earthly kingdoms, whether the state recognizes it or not. But you have a kind of a unity underneath the papacy.
The body of Christ isn't just the church. The body of Christ is church and state together.
Right. The Pope is pictured as having the staff in one hand and the globe in the other. He is actually the ruler over it all.
Then in Lutheranism, Anglicanism, and some Reformed churches, particularly the Reformed Church in Germany, there was a different approach, wasn't there?
Yeah, we would try to follow what Luther set out as the doctrine of the two kingdoms, the kingdom of the right and the kingdom of the left.
And that wasn't Republican and Democrat?
No.
Okay.
No, not in its time. What he basically said was the kingdom on the left is the kingdom of the civil authority, and the prince is there by God's mandate, and you want to do everything you can to have one that understands justice and exercises justice. And you want to make sure he's kind of smart. You're not going to elect him or encourage him to be elected because he's a believing Christian. And then on the kingdom on the right, you have the kingdom of the church, which exercises no real power other than the power of the gospel. They have the word and the sacraments, and that's it. Not the sword, no baptisms by immersion at sword's point, thank you. All it has is the word and the sacraments and the power thereof, the spirit within them.
Mm. Well, and then the Calvinistic position argued the right of revolution. Calvin insisted that you needed a lesser magistrate if you were going to have a revolution.
Right.
And then Beza developed it more fully in his full-length treatise on the right of resistance. That really was a kernel from which the theory of a right of resistance and right of revolution developed.
Yeah, it's a very important point.
How's an evil man like Nero considered God's servant?
That's really a tough one. Nero certainly is going to be judged for his actions, but Nero was raised up by God for that time and place as head of state, and at the same time Nero is using the bodies of Christians to be torches to light his garden, he is at the same time paying for roads and shipping lanes, and so you see Paul traveling by ship from place to place. How is that kind of thing held in place? It's the order, the ability to keep things from going to absolute anarchy, that even though Nero was a horrible, oppressive ruler, God says through Paul here in Romans 13 that government is his minister for that purpose.
The other thing is that you have an Old Testament precedent for this too, Cyrus of Persia. The Lord is under no obligation to have us under rulers that make us feel comfortable.
Mm.
In fact, he has every right to do the other and has historically done that. And we have very little grounds to object.
Yeah, in fact, in the prophets, I will bring so-and-so from the east and so-and-so.
Or the north.
Yeah, king so-and-so from the north. And I will bring them in to carry you away by fishhooks. And
yep.
God uses even... Pharaoh and...
Well, let's face it, too. The church oftentimes does better under persecution than it does when it is identified with government.
It's interesting here, too, on verse 4, where he says that rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do wrong. And he says, then do what is right, and he will commend you, for he is God's servant to do you good, but if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword for nothing. He is God's servant, an agent of wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. John Murray says on that verse, it's not the magistrate's prerogative to deal with all sin, but only with sin registered in the action which violates the order that the magistrate is appointed to maintain and promote.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what we often hear. We think we want a Christian in there because he's going to legislate our idea of how we would like people to behave.
But right.
What Murray,
yes.
Murray's saying yes. here is, look, Paul is saying, look for a magistrate who will preserve order,
mm-hmm.
who will do what a magistrate is supposed to do,
mm-hmm.
not someone who will make people into good people.
Right.
In 1 Timothy 2:2, Paul tells us to pray for kings and rulers that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in all godliness and fear.
Yeah, I think both of our traditions would say that the calling of the state is to bring some kind of first use of the law order so that the gospel can be preached
exactly.
by the church,
what's
not the by
first
the state.
Use, what's the first use of
the
law?
Oh, the first use of law is that the prince will keep some degree of order so that there's safety, basic safety for the inhabitants. And the reformers said that was the necessary prerequisite that the church would preach the gospel in the nation.
Verse 6, he says, this is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give everyone what you owe him. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor.
And boy, do we owe taxes.
Yeah. I mean, with this, and in the light of what Jesus said about the Caesar's image on the coin, render unto Caesar.
Render unto Caesar.
At what point, for instance, we think of the revolution and what sparked it was taxes. Is it justifiable for Christians... not to protest, but to actually refuse to pay taxes if they believe that that is tyrannical?
Well, I don't think we're given that right here. Why do you pay taxes? Because God's authority are God's servants. I don't think that option is given to us.
But
in
we
that
can
case.
Protest
but
in a democracy.
We can protest in a
Absolutely.
Democracy.
Absolutely.
And we should protest.
And say, we think that the taxes are about 93 times higher than they should be.
Yeah. Well, interesting questions. I'm sure that many of our callers are asking a lot of the same questions, so let's get to them now. Dave in Mariposa, California. Good evening. Dave, what's your question?
It was along the lines of taxes. I heard, I'm not sure, whether the IRS is not even part of the government. It's a totally different entity altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything much about that?
I
was not part of my seminary training.
Yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting question. First of all, there are all kinds of different views that a Christian can maintain. I think what we're all agreed on here is regardless of whether you think the taxes are too high or whether they're fine and they provide for legitimate services or whatever, that a Christian is obligated to obey the ruling authorities, even if he chooses to protest. The reason he has a right to protest is because he is a loyal citizen. You know, I feel like a little bit like Stuart Smalley on Saturday Night Live. Okay, this is not our best show. Because, you know, it's really tough to get excited about this subject, I have to say. I know that Paul is an inspired apostle. He's absolutely right. But it's difficult in a democracy where we take so much sense of responsibility for our government to not sort of get outraged at the... I was talking to a guy on the plane today from Paris, and he said, You know, I think in France, he's been living here for a while, he's in business, and he said, in Paris, we have socialized, everything is socialized. But he says, we pay the same amount of taxes as you guys do. But you have free health care, free education, free universities, free everything. And, you know, you do think about the enormous taxes and yet so little to show for it. You still see homeless people out on the streets and all kinds of...
It takes a lot to support the Washington Beltway and the structures that we've created in our government. Those guys would be without a job if we didn't pay this amount of taxes. You know, they might be unemployed.
It is amazing that the people living in the bedroom communities of Washington, D.C. have the highest per capita income outside of Orange County, the highest percentage per capita income in the nation. And those are the civil servants. Those are the bureaucrats. And hope we don't get any angry calls from the Washington, D.C. listening area tonight.
Heavens.
Pat in Tustin, California, good evening.
Hi, I was just calling in response to the gentleman who just called asking about the IRS, and I did wanted to let him know that it is not an entity, and also the Federal Reserve Bank is a privately held corporation, and that all our money, as it says in the back of your check that I assume you're going to mail in for your taxes, will says paid to the Federal Reserve Bank on the debt owed to the United States Treasury. But we don't pay anything to the United States Treasury. The Federal Reserve takes it. It's a privately held corporation. And if that's true and it's being usurped, why should we have to pay it? We're not a democracy, by the way. We may be now, but we were established as a republic.
Yep.
Each one of us speaking for ourselves. And so now it's a democracy. We got mobocracy.
Yep.
But really,
it's a great point.
So we're not rebelling against paying our taxes. We want to pay it to the real people, to the real government.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's where us people are getting the name of protesters and bad news. It isn't true. We just want it to go where it's supposed to, support the people.
Pat, thanks a lot for
that's
the call.
That's a great call.
Nicely said.
Absolutely.
Very well said.
Eric in Alpine, New Jersey.
Yes, hi. How are you?
All right.
How did Luther deal with the fact that he was essentially a civil outlaw under the edict of Emperor Charles for most of his life?
He hid a lot.
He had dukes steal him away and put him in a castle.
Right, and lived alone and translated Hebrew and Greek.
That is a good question.
Yeah.
How did Luther justify that?
Well, the harder question is Luther and the Peasants' Revolt. There's the one where, if you really want to focus on this thing.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, many of the German people felt as if Luther would step right in as the revolutionary leader up against the papacy. And so when they rebelled, they expected to have immediate help from Luther and got just the opposite. He had a terrific fear of anarchy, which we've made reference to earlier in the show, and wrote to the princes instead to quell the peasants' revolt. The peasants felt totally betrayed. Afterwards, Luther tried to chase that down with another letter, but it was too late. The genie was out of the bottle, and he never really regained that trust of the peasantry after that move. But Luther was not a revolutionary. If you think of it in terms of poli-sci, he was a very conservative guy who feared anarchy with every cell of his being.
Mm.
So that was one of the darkest moments in our history.
Mm. How about Jay in Austin, Texas?
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
All right, how are you doing?
Good. I was just wondering, in the 22nd chapter of Matthew, where Jesus said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's, what was he really talking about to give to God? Because it seems like that really everything's God's.
Wouldn't we say that's obedience? I mean, Peter in his first epistle says, fear God, honor the king. And so we are to give honor to Caesar and tribute and taxes and whatever is proper to the secular authorities. But we are to give to God, not honor, but fear, reverence, obedience, and worship. And,
I'd be glad.
That's a great way to go at
that. I'd be glad to take that approach to taxes, too. I think that has a lot of promise. To see if people can find a few coins in fish mouths and send that in to Washington, D.C. I think it's a wonderful approach to taxation.
Paul in Portland, Oregon or Portland, California?
Oregon.
Okay, that's...
How you doing?
All right, how are you doing?
Is this the Paul?
Hey, is this our Paul?
Paul, yeah. Paul, yeah.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to hear your voice.
Hey, I just want to know, how far do we go in the submission to the authorities? Where do we draw the line?
Call me at my home phone number, Paul.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is a question, particularly with Operation Rescue. A lot of people are asking, you know, what do you do about something like that? First of all, I think... if a person is involved in transgressing a law that is unjust, that, from a Christian perspective, as I would see it, is obeying God rather than man.
Yeah, exactly.
But in a situation like this, they're not transgressing
an unjust law.
The law they're breaking is trespassing, and I don't want people to feel like they can trespass on church property.
The reason ACT UP can't come in and disrupt my worship service is because of that same trespassing law. However, it's got to be said that for people who oppose abortion, this becomes a matter of conscience.
Yeah.
And there is latitude here as to how far we as Christians can go in opposing government, because it becomes a matter of conscience, and there's a certain sense which is you have to be careful not to pry into others' consciences.
How do you think that Calvin's way of resolving this made any sense in terms of you cannot overthrow a government no matter how tyrannical it is, but what you ought to do is go in and try to find lesser magistrates. Okay, your president, let's say, or your king is putting you all to the stake. What do you do? Go and try to find lesser magistrates, so in our...
A prince, you know, a duke, or
a senate, or a congress, and get them to overthrow. Now, in our system, that would be impeachment, wouldn't it?
Right.
So, really, what Calvin was arguing for there... We have, in a certain sense, we have those kinds of controls, those kinds of possibilities.
But we can't attack the government as an institution, even if that institution's leaders are using the power of that institution to tyrannize the church. We can appeal to lesser magistrates to overthrow tyrants, but we can't, in a sense, attack the system.
I find it remarkable that at a time when... You know, Cousin Fred was being dipped in wax and put in Nero's garden.
Well, that's amazing.
That your apostle was telling you had to pray for the guy.
That's amazing when you think about it. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't that say that Paul put the gospel before everything else?
Yes, clearly.
Bob in Lancaster, California.
Hi, Mike. I had a question about sovereign citizenry. I got some friends that are getting involved in that, and what's your response to that?
I don't have the slightest. Are you talking about where you transfer your citizenship from the federal to the state government?
Right, where you opt out of the Social Security, pull out of taxes.
Yeah, I don't know enough about that. All we can say from the text, we don't have any political positions at CURE.
Oh, of course we do.
Well, they're all different.
Yeah, we all hold different views politically, but I think where we're all agreed is what the text says here, that if you can, whatever you do, you better do it legally. You can't do anything that is a violation of the authorities that God has placed over us. Peter in Silver Springs, Maryland.
Hi, how are you doing?
All right, how are you?
I don't know, very good. It's the first time I've heard your show. It's very interesting. So far.
Now, you're in Silver Spring, but you're not a government employee, right?
No, I'm not a government employee.
Okay.
I'm right outside of Washington, D.C.
Outside the Beltway. We don't want to offend our friends who are serving the government.
Of course I do.
In the Beltway.
Of course I do.
I expected you to say that, Ron.
That was a straight line if I ever heard one.
What's your question, Peter?
Well, I want to ask you about a number of years ago, well, actually for the past several years in Washington, D.C., the issue of statehood has been pretty important for a lot of citizens wanting to have representation in Congress. I think it was either last year or the year before, there were a number of leaders who felt that taxation without representation was unfair for Washington, D.C., and had thought about not paying their taxes but putting their taxes in escrow account as sort of protest for not having representation. I wanted to find out what you would think about that in light of the fact that our country is typically connected taxes with congressional representation.
Thanks, Peter.
I think that's one legitimate way to go at it. I know that at present there's some big doctrinal disputes in mainline denominations, particularly the Presbyterian Church USA, over this imagining conference, and what some of the churches are doing are placing their denominational shares in escrow, not sending them to the denomination at present, but holding them for when that time comes, the denomination returns to its fidelity on Scripture. I think you could apply the same thing to government. I don't know. I'm sure there'd be a difference of opinion here, maybe, but I think that would be a viable option.
Dave in Denver.
Hello.
How are you?
Fine, thank you. I hope you're doing better now.
Yes, much better. Thank you. I got it out of my system.
I had a comment. Believers have been engaged in various forms of civil disobedience for millennia. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego didn't bow down before the image that Nebuchadnezzar created. The early Christians did not worship Caesar and because they saw Christ as their king. You mentioned the idea of the covenant that government has with the people. I think that was partly what our founders thought when they signed the Declaration of Independence, that they had broken the covenant relationship that they should have. They had a humongous list of grievances. Taxes is just one.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that it reached the point where it was tyranny. They're not listening to us. They're not working with us, no matter what we do. So enough's enough.
Yeah. Yeah, and appreciate that, Dave. And the thing about it, too, is, you know, with all of this in the background, all of the debate and discussion of the right of resistance and so forth, that approach of the right of resistance by using lesser magistrates really was profoundly important in the shaping of our republican institutions. And I think that's one thing we really ought to be thankful with all of its problems that God has given us the opportunity to live in a country that does allow us to make our grievances known.
I think we do have a means of appeal here.
Oh, it'd be wonderful. For instance, you could solve the deficit problem very quickly by cutting the size of the federal government to 1/20th of what it is. You'd have money left over. There are all sorts of possibilities, and you can do that with a vote by throwing all the rascals out.
It's not our favorite subject, talking about politics, especially at a time when politics is very much the only thing that being discussed.
Tragically, politics has become much of evangelical religion.
Yeah.
And I think all of us feel that when you start to look back at Romans chapter 13 and look at Paul's view of the state and the church, the Christian's individual relationship to culture, it's really time to go back and rethink a lot of these things.
It sure doesn't give us a place to look at to view the state as the answer to our spiritual and moral problems, does it?
No, not if we hold to the two kingdoms doctrine from the Reformation.
So, if we want spiritual transformation, it's going to be through the Word. If we want to see changes in the civil sphere, that's through the governmental sphere that's proper to it.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. For more information about supporting our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also visit us online at whitehorseinn.org. That's whitehorsein.org.